Okay, we're going to call the Health and Human Services Committee together. Today we're going to do a public hearing. We'll start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 183.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 183 extends the rural medical professional liability reinsurance program operated by the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation through to 2011. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. Dr. Bates. Senator Bates. Senator Dr. Bates.
I want some certified smart people up here.
Are there any certified smart people in the room?
One there.
Please step forward if there are. Okay.
Well, I sure don't see any.
Oh, there are three of them coming.
If they're certified smart people, they wouldn't be here, would they?
Two out of three of them are certified smart.
I see.
Can figure out who they are pretty quickly.
Okay, we'll see who runs the machine. That's the certified smart people.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from the deep south of Oregon, Medford and Ashland, and also a practicing physician down there. You have three people in front of you, two of whom I will certify as smart, and I'm the third one. I will present this as quickly as I can without screwing it up for you and go from there. First, I want to tell you that it's been a real pleasure last summer to be a practicing physician and senator in Southern Oregon with the Oregonian and our local newspaper roasting me daily about a program which, frankly, has worked extremely well in the state, but in which one area we had some problems, and that problem was in my backyard in Ashland. As you may well know, I was accused of cutting a deal for my local physicians, which I want to go on record as saying I did not, and didn't even know it was going on until I was informed of what was going on by the newspapers. Last week I flew down and had a long discussion with the local physicians who were affected by this bill and by the changes in this bill. They were extremely gracious about this and worked with us on it. Understood the ramifications of the entire bill, what we were trying to do with the bill initially and which we accomplished, and that there were things that had occurred along the way that were sort of unintended consequences that unfortunately do happen sometimes. I want to talk for a few minutes about what it means to be a rural physician or a nurse practitioner or provider, and the special challenges they have and how this program's worked. I also want to take a moment and thank the work group that worked at some very difficult times and hours with me. They were kind enough to get up and at home at 4:30 in the morning and meet me at 7 o'clock in the Capitol. And we went up north a couple times and worked with them, and I appreciate the hard work and hours put into this, particularly by Corey Streisinger, who's to my left, Scott Ekblad, Ariel Schmidt, Elizabeth Snyder, Kate Newhall, Reese Sailors, Joyce Patton, Lou Savage, Janine Smith, Representatives Comp and Maurer. We all worked hard on this, and if I missed anybody, I apologize. Did I miss anyone?
That sounds pretty good.
Pretty good. Didn't miss anybody, I hope. And we crafted something that may at first look fairly complex, and I'm going to ask you to bear with us as we go through it. It is fairly complex in some ways, but it really is very elegant. It's well-crafted, and I think it answers the needs of rural providers within the framework of the amount of financial resources we have to deal with this. For people dealing with health care in rural parts of Oregon, and by that I mean areas which are underserved primarily, these are people who, as individuals, have made a commitment to their communities to treat and care everyone. When we check the 1,000...
Excuse me for just a minute. Let's kind of set the framework and timeline. Where are we with this bill? This is a public hearing. What do you have to do before we're ready to seriously consider moving this bill? Do you have amendments coming?
We have at least two amendments that have to be completed for this, which LC has not completed.
Okay.
Until it's completed, we're not going to be able to move the bill for
okay.
you.
Okay. But you're going to go through the amendments, so we will have the substance of the bill. And if all things go well, we will get the amendments and we'll be able to move it. So, okay. So
I
just wanted to clarify that before we got too
far.
Yes,
we are not ready to move the bill today because we don't have the written.
Well, I understood that, but I just was wondering where you were on the amendments.
We hope to have those back by early next week. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These physicians and nurse practitioners have made a real commitment to the community to treat everyone there. We surveyed them. We found that of the over 1,000 individuals involved, only 8 of them had their practices closed to patients of any kind. And we believe those were primarily individuals who were closing on their practices because of age or retirement or other reasons. We didn't have a chance to check back on those 8 directly. These people work for low reimbursement rates. The payer mix in rural Oregon is heavily in Medicaid, heavily in Medicare, and heavily in uninsured. There's a very small commercial market, so these people make much less salaries than they could make elsewhere. As a result, this program was put together by the governor and done in a very elegant fashion also initially. Now, the reimbursement rates for obstetricians and family practitioners doing obstetricians and family practitioners and general practitioners has been such that we have not had a significant loss in any physicians or nurse practitioners or providers in rural Oregon in the last 4 years. The initial money has been stretched to go for another 4 years on the amendments you'll see. And I think that you'll find that when we go through it, it'll make some sense to you why we did things and why we are doing them and recommending them to you. The changes you'll see, some of which are rather significant, are this. One, we want to maintain obstetrics primary care in rural Oregon for very obvious reasons. We also need to maintain some other specialties, primarily general surgery and anesthesiology, because without that you can't do obstetrics at times in rural Oregon. We also found that nurse practitioners, of which there were many more in the rural area than I thought there were, over 400, were often in the position that a nurse practitioner would be working alongside a physician, seeing the same patient, doing many of the same things, and paying a higher malpractice premium than the physician was as a result of the supplement. This bill rectifies that problem also. It also redefines to a certain degree what rural is. We have areas in the state which, under the old definition, being an epicenter of 40,000 people 10 miles out, would qualify as a rural area, when in fact they really weren't, actually being a good example of that. It's a highly urbanized area. It is 10.2 miles from a 40,000 population center in Medford, but that 0.2 mile really isn't that significant, and they are highly urbanized. For that reason, action has been taken out of the rural setting. I would offer that one of the amendments you'll see, however, because there are several physicians who are primary care physicians doing obstetrics in Ashland, and their population of patients they serve is primarily Latinos from a fully capitated health center, La Clinica, we are recommending that be put on what we call a glide path, where their subsidy is decreased over the next 4 years rather rapidly, so they have a chance to adjust to those changes. Other than that, the physicians in action will no longer be in this program. They understand that.
Question on this?
Yes.
It's my understanding that Grants Pass now is not considered rural. It is. Because of its population.
The amendments you'll see are the following. One, Grants Pass is still in the program. Grants Pass population is, in fact, not changed. What happened was Grants Pass, which had a catchment basin around it, decided to annex a small piece of property which raised just above the 40,000 mark. We've elected to keep Grants Pass and its surrounding areas in the catchment basin and in this program. Reason being, again, retention and ability to bring in new physicians. The payer mix in Grants Pass is dramatically different than it is, for instance, in Medford and Ashland, even though they're only about 20 or 30 miles apart. Similarly, Roseburg, Myrtle Point, Canyonville have the same exact problems as the rest of your rural Oregon. No commercial base to their population, lots of Medicaid, lots of Medicare, and lots of uninsured.
Well, just a follow-up then.
Yes.
Because I actually had one of Senator Cruz's constituents come to me, and she's a volunteer EMT. And with the change in Grants Pass, she always got her $250 credit for being a volunteer EMT, and now that's going to be taken away from her. Can we let her know that's not going to happen?
I may be in error in saying this. I don't believe that's the case, but I can find out.
I could, Senator and Mr. Chair, Senator Mark Sanderson, the tax credit program is not affected by this bill, and I have been informed that the Grants Pass situation, the tax, because the definition that this bill hooks onto is the tax credit definition, that Grants Pass may have a problem for the tax credit. We are grandfathering in Grants Pass for this program, but this bill doesn't address the tax credit program, so you may need to look at that separately.
I think we need to look at that separately.
I'm wondering if we can look at that at the same time we're doing this and simply change the status of Grants Pass. Senator Cruz.
Well, interesting, but it's two separate issues. I think we need to keep them separate. Dr. Bates, just to cut to the chase, outside of doctors in Ashland, is any physician currently in the program not going to be in it with the reconfiguration?
Yes, there will be. Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, two classes. One, Independence and
Albany.
And Albany will not be in the program. And there are certain specialists in the urban and in the rural areas that will be on a rather rapid glide path to take them out of the program. The reason being that we selected those, one, because we didn't have enough money to stretch for 4 years, we didn't do it, but two, and more importantly, the difference in income in those specialties are such that we felt that the reimbursement was not necessary for them to be retained. I called around the state as part of the work plan and discussed this at length with stakeholders in each of the areas, the directors of the FCHIPs, various physicians, and the consensus I got was very clear. For primary care, for obstetrics, for general surgeons, for anesthesiologists, we need them to stay in the program the way it is. For others, it is not a necessity, and we didn't think it would be significant impact on our rural communities for the other subspecialties.
A follow-up? Actually, it's not a follow-up. It's a different question. Was one of the drivers in your calculations to keep the with the resources currently in the fund to keep it viable for 4 years?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
I just want to be clear on the glide path and versus elimination outright. Will any physicians be eliminated from the program outright?
Yes, Senator Morissette, yes, they will.
Okay, could you go? Okay, so you've limited to the category that you mentioned as being the important category, and people who are not in the category are not going to be in a glide path. They're simply going to be out of it, right?
There will be some that will actually be out of it, okay? Others will be on a glide path.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Senator, the urbanized area, Ashland, Albany, and Independence, with the exception that the Senator mentioned, they will be off the program. The non-primary care physicians will have a glide path that will reduce their level of subsidy, but they will not be eliminated under this four-year period, although the subsidy percentage will be considerably smaller by the fourth year.
Okay. Now let me try it one more time. All of the physicians in Ashland will be eliminated from the program. No glide path. Is that correct?
With the exception of those physicians, and if you accept the amendments.
Okay.
With the exception of those few physicians who are doing obstetrics there.
Thank you.
They will be placed on a glide path. They're not dropped off a cliff.
That's what I thought you said.
And the rest of the state, as far as this program is concerned, there used to be a 40% subsidy for what we're talking about, the subspecialty group. That subsidy will go from 30 down to 35%, 25%, 15%, and end up at 15%. There are factors here we can't completely predict, and we need the ability to move that glide path as necessary. We have stated that we will pay a flat amount based in 2007 premiums against the premiums that physicians will be paying. That is still a generous subsidy.
Okay.
Secondly, there may be new nurse practitioners, new physicians coming to this program in a rural area. That's what we like to see happen. If that happens, we may have to accelerate the glide path for the subspecialists and specialists in order to afford the program for them. And the other issue we've got here is even on the present glide path we're on, we're still a little short of this. We've got about $19 million for the program. We're probably $1.5 million short to make this program really work. This bill's going to go to Ways and Means, obviously. I've been working with the co-chairs on this, and we believe we can identify the money we need to maintain this program. So when it leaves your committee, if in fact it leaves the committee the way we hope it does, there's still work for us to do in ways and means to make sure it's funded properly so we can maintain the program the way we're describing it to you.
Good. Thank you. Is that it?
If I could be excused, there's others who would like to walk you through the program a little more carefully than I have, and I would like to allow them to do so.
Now, let me go back and verify another thing that you said. Albany and Independence are no longer in the program, as is Ashland not in the program. Or as Ashland is not in the program. Okay. But the same category of physicians will remain that are the obstetrics. Thank you. So the same category of physicians in those two cities that will remain in Ashland will continue to be on the glide path.
That would be the case. I'm not sure there are anyone doing obstetrics in those cities. I have to go back and check. I'm not sure there's anybody in Albany or in Independence doing obstetrics.
Primary care physicians who deliver babies, are they in the program in Albany?
Mr. Chair, according to our numbers, there are actually only one participating doctor in Albany and only one in Independence, and they are not in obstetrics or family practitioners included in obstetrics. They're in the other category. Now, those are the numbers that we were working with. And
I believe you're right.
Okay. So the other category meaning that they're not in the program.
Correct. They, under these amendments, would not be in the program at all. Okay. Because of the nature of their practice, not because we treat the community differently.
I just wanted to be clear about those other two cities as well. Thank you.
Okay. So yeah. I'm going to step aside. Is anything else coming up besides?
I think Scott was held up in traffic.
So I hear there's some horrendous traffic jam going on right now, I guess. I will stay up here for questions, but I'd like to turn it over to the two certified smart people who will probably make more sense out of this than I did for you.
Thank you. Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I actually have very little to add because the Senator covered the proposed amendments and the program fairly thoroughly. There are a couple of handouts in front of you. One of them is a report that our department was directed to prepare on the performance of the program over the past 4 years. And we talked about a great deal of this material when we were before this committee a couple of months ago, but the report is now in final because it has the 2006 numbers. So if you want to see how the program has run thus far, if you look at pages 2 and 3, for example, you'll see the statistics on participating physicians and how they break down in practice areas. And then, in fact, the appendix in the back gives you county by county and specialty by specialty, so it allows you to actually see where the program is today. Then there's also a very sort of brief one-page summary of the amendments that the work group is proposing. And as the Senator indicated, that's a little bit of there are still a few issues that are not represented in that summary, like the issue of the obstetricians in the urbanized areas. But briefly, the program, in summary, as the Senator's outlined, would do some slight modifications to the geographic areas by grandfathering in, if you will, Grants Pass as well as Rogue River. That's the other community which would be included in the definitions. We would do that by saying if you were in the program as rural in 2004 when the program started, we're not going to eliminate you from the program just because of population change. But then communities which are considered urbanized under the census definition, that being Albany, Independence, and Ashland, would be out. So those are the geographic fine-tunings that the work group came up with. The subsidy levels would stay the same for obstetricians at 80%, family practitioners with OB at 60%, but the remainder of the doctors who were all at 40% are now divided into the two groups. So primary care, that's a specific list of specialties that were identified by the group as being necessary for primary care, would stay at the 40% level, and then the remaining specialties would have a glide path that would reduce their participation over time. The bill specifies percentages, 35% down to 15, but those are subject, as the senator said, to being reduced further if funding is inadequate, and funding might not be adequate to make those percentages come forth. One other factor that I don't think has been mentioned is the recommendation that in order to be eligible, doctors serve Medicare and Medicaid patients, and as Senator Bates indicated, they do. So we're not anticipating at this point that this would mean any doctors losing eligibility, but because this is a public subsidy program, we thought it was useful and important to articulate that we are expecting public service as these doctors regularly provide. And we are recognizing the role of nurse practitioners and certified nurse midwives in providing primary care in rural Oregon. So they would be included at the same tiers as physicians. So nurse midwives, for example, would be at that 80% tier. General practice nurse midwife would be at the 40% tier. There's one other small item that
Ms.
I want
Chair,
to mention.
Before you leave that, do you have a breakout of those folks by county? I mean, Alan, you said there's like 400 of them. Do we know where they are? And did you look at PAs in that mix at all?
PAs come under PAs are a different category than nurse practitioners are, and they come under the malpractice coverage of the physician they directly work for. They can't work independently while nurse practitioners can, so they're covered by the physician they're attached to.
And Mr. Chair, OHSU gave me a copy by county
of the
participating total number, and it doesn't say. I think it's just all physicians.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we don't have as precise numbers on nurse practitioners as we do on physicians. We did some informal surveying, and we talked to the Nurses Association. We got rough numbers, but we don't have a precise county-by-county breakdown. The malpractice premiums are quite a bit smaller, so we've done estimating in terms of the cost, the programmatic cost. We can't be as precise as we can be for doctors simply because they haven't been in the program and we don't have the fine-tuning. The one other area that came up is what about physicians who purchase coverage through a hospital or medical care facility? The program as originally structured only applies to doctors who buy their own coverage independently. And that's still the basic framework here, but we created the possibility of an exception for a doctor who really does buy his or her coverage independently, but buys it through a medical care facility where they're not employed, but potentially allows them to take advantage of group rates, for example. We don't actually know if there are physicians in that category, but we did hear concern about some additional flexibility for physicians who get insurance through medical facilities, so we put that exception in the event that it could be useful.
Sure, but they would still have to be individually purchasing, but through a group.
Correct. Individually named and priced. So that's the gist of it, and as I said, not a lot to add, and we're all happy, I think, to answer any questions.
Okay. Any other questions?
I want to see the amendments, Ms. Chair.
We, Mr. Chair, we do too. It's been a slow process. Yeah, I really want to thank this work group. I mean, they were getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to drive down, and we worked hard for 2 or 3 hours every time. And at one time, we looked at 20 different maps of overlays of the state as far as rural. We looked at, I think, at least 20 glide paths, which you started getting so blurred in your mind you couldn't figure out, trying to make this $19 million work, bring in nurse practitioners, work with what we thought were really primary care providers, both nurse practitioners and physicians, that we really need to take care of those that we don't. I mean, it was really a lot of slogging it out, hard work. But I think what they've come up with is really elegant and well done. I looked at it now 3 or 4 times and spent some time reading through it and thought, this is really good work. This is the kind of stuff I like to see the legislature do. It was bipartisan. We had Republicans and Democrats in there working with us, and it was nice to see it come together. I'm hoping that the amendments reflect that work properly so we can bring it back to you, hopefully within a week, and knowing that we're on timelines now to get this stuff out, we can get it rolling.
Did you have anything?
I have background information on how the subsidies work
to date. Go
ahead.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Arielle Smith. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Yes.
I did a analysis looking at the SAFE database and also surveying physicians to find out what's happened up through 2006 with the subsidy to see how it's been working, and have information on that if you would like to go through that with me.
Yes, we have a conference call coming in at
a little bit of time.
And
would we be able to get a hard copy of that?
There is a handout of the slides.
Okay.
It's a real extensive handout. I was only planning to go through the highlights, but you can definitely look through that.
Yeah, why don't you give us the highlights?
Okay. So
now, let me, I'm sorry. We have a call coming in from Ashland, Dr. Rawlings, by phone, and that will be 3:45.
Yeah. Okay.
So go ahead.
All right, 8 minutes. Myself and my colleagues at Oregon Health and Sciences have done some analysis of the program, looking, like I said, at the SAFE database and at doing a survey of physicians. Basically, just a little background information. We had initially done a survey in 2002 that found that many family physicians and OBGYNs who were delivering babies were stopping. One of the things that came out of all of that discussion was the initial malpractice subsidy. I think we've gone through the eligibility and how it worked. Basically, we did a mail survey of all the physicians who are receiving the subsidy, as well as looking at the SAFE database. Got a lot of responses. According to the SAFE database, about 1,100 physicians got the subsidy in the first 2 years, which is the data that we had. There were about $10 million spent. Ended up being heavily sent to rural and frontier counties. That the three-quarters of all the money went to very rural areas, and the majority of the physicians who received it were in primary care, and about a third delivered babies. And this is just a graphic of the geographic distribution of where the money went. This is by the work address of the physician. We found a couple of things when we surveyed physicians. Quite a few of them didn't realize they were getting the subsidy, so we've corrected that in the new edition by having them reapply every year so that they're at least aware of it. There are many reasons why they may not have been aware, but there quite a few weren't. Many of them thought that the subsidy was very important. 85% of those who delivered babies said it was a very important piece in their ability to continue to provide delivery services, and about 80% of those who were doing prenatal care. But you also found a lot in trauma care, surgery, and providing care for the payers who historically pay less, such as Medicare and Medicaid. When asked if they would stop doing any services if they stopped receiving the subsidy, about 85% of those who delivered babies said that they would seriously consider stopping doing deliveries if the subsidy were to be discontinued. And about two-thirds of those who were doing prenatal care indicated they would stop doing so. And another 29% would seriously consider leaving a rural community. Subsidized physicians were significantly more likely to do surgical services or care for hospitalized patients or ICU patients than those who didn't get the subsidy. They weren't more likely to provide maternity care and obstetrics, partly because the physicians who weren't in the program because of working for the Indian Health Service or something else were probably doing a lot of UOB care. Many of them who weren't doing the subsidy did so because half of them were employed by a health plan. A few didn't know about it, and some of them didn't realize they were in rural areas. So basically, this is a really important subsidy for physicians to provide high-risk services. They are more likely to provide these services if they are subsidized, and they have pretty concerning plans to stop providing services or stop providing rural care if the subsidy is discontinued or at least discontinued suddenly. Looking just specifically at the maternity care providers, we're still losing them at a pretty good rate in the state. About 44% of all physicians who were trained to deliver babies were delivering them in 02, and this had fallen to about 33% in 06. So they're definitely continuing to decline at a pretty rapid rate. And this is true of urban and rural and all different specialties. Main reason is still liability cost and interference with lifestyles, another reason. Those who are older and solo practice and those kind of like classic rural docs are the more likely to quit doing maternity care, which is also concerning. Liability is still a major reason to quit. The subsidy didn't seem to really affect whether people were planning on quitting or not, and there's lots of different reasons for that. We actually last week got together with a group of hospital administrators and physicians who were providing maternity services to find out why they were still quitting at such a high rate. And they were saying that the subsidy is vitally important to them. They also need other things like better reimbursement, particularly Medicaid, hospitals that they can work with who are good collaborators, and also some type of either additional partners or some sort of a respite care program or something so they can take vacations. Other things. So there's lots of different features involved in why these people are quitting, but this is definitely an important piece that's keeping them continuing to do maternity care. Also, if we suddenly stop the subsidy, they're going to have about a $55,000 increase in the average cost of malpractice for an OBGYN in the state. That's based on CNA data. So that's going to be a pretty significant sudden increase in business costs for a lot of these folks. So basic summary points, this is very important to a lot of these rural docs, very important to providing high-risk services. There's still some problems with OB that we need to work out, but this is definitely helping at least slow what's probably would have been an accelerating trend. And then there's some communication knowledge receipt problems that we're fixing by having them reapply every year through the Office of Rural Health. Do you have any particular questions? I also
yes.
have a report that
What's
you
going to happen when they come to the edge of the cliff and drop off?
When
the future of funding the program after the four-year period?
A very good question. And it's obviously time for me to leave. No, seriously, the problem of medical malpractice and the cost of medical malpractice has to be decided in the next two sessions of this legislature, I believe. This gives us a four-year window of opportunity in rural, but nothing in urban. The cost of medical malpractice in the state falls into two categories. One is the actual cost of the premiums paid and the payouts made by insurers to patients who have been injured. If you look at that from the point of view of the total cost of health care in the state on a given year, it is, believe it or not, 0.8% of the total cost of health care. It is just a flicker on the screen. If you look at it from the point of view of a physician or nurse practitioner, it is often the biggest part of their cost of doing business, ranging anywhere from 20% to 50%, depending on their specialty and what that premium is they pay. We are looking at programs right now which would mimic in some ways the programs that are available and have been pioneered by the lawyers in our state, the attorneys in our state, a secondary pool of health, a premium payment insurance, a subsidy for physicians and nurse practitioners in high-risk pools across the state that is similar to what we're doing in rural health. The real cost of this to the country and to the state is what we call defensive medicine. While we talk about 0.8% as being a premium cost and being a very high cost to individual physicians, we estimate the cost of the entire healthcare industry between 10% and 12% of the total cost of healthcare. That means we're spending approximately $1.2 or $3 billion a year of our healthcare dollars in defensive medicine, which is something we need to address. We believe there are ways to address that. We're working on programs right now that would be brought forward in the next session for consideration by the legislature to start dealing with those issues.
Senator George.
Senator Bates, I was watching a person on a TV program here recently. When I was sick, I watched a lot of stuff. I should have been taking care of myself instead of worrying. He used a number of 30 to 40%. And it was a pretty substantial interview with physician. In other words, a polling was done. How much is defensive practice? And they were estimating at 30% to 40%. Have you ever heard a number that high?
Chair Morissette and Senator George, we have heard numbers as high as that. It's something that's hard to quantitate. I like to use the lower number because I'm fairly certain I can back that up with facts. There are people who believe that in certain specialties, like in emergency medicine, mm-hmm. it might well be that high, that in obstetrics it might well be that high. We know that we can prove with a certain amount of certainty it's at least 10 to 12%. And when you think of 0.8% compared to 10% to 12%, and the cost to all of us for that. We've got to find some way of linking those together, that we're going to help physicians from the point of view of their medical malpractice issues so they don't practice so much defensive medicine. We all will be served better that way. Patients who have been injured will still be compensated as much as we can for things that happen of that nature. Physicians will be protected against indemnity and hopefully will practice less defensive medicine, and we'll all be better served. I would also offer that in this area of defensive medicine, there's potential for harm being done. There's a case right now that is going to be probably heard fairly soon, which an individual, small child, had a seizure, a febrile seizure, one which commonly happens with kids. Parents were very concerned, pushed very hard, and wanted an MRI of their child's brain done to make sure there's nothing wrong. I think it was a one-year-old. To do an MRI takes 30 or 35 minutes. You have to sedate the child to do it. The child ultimately got the MRI, was sedated, had intubation done so they could be sedated and breathing maintained, got the MRI done, the MRI was normal. The child unfortunately aspirated into its lungs, got pneumonia, and died. The child died. It's defensive medicine at its very worst. And that's the kind of things we have to stop happening. Another sad case of a system that just doesn't function the way it should.
Mr. Chairman, this is more of a comment, but as the three of you were doing this presentation, I was thinking about aviation. Now, that may sound strange, but we had aviation manufacturers all over the place, and they're primarily gone now. And what happened to them was they got sued for so many things that were so far out beyond reasonable that I can remember when I had a Cessna Centurion, and I was getting AD notices on stuff like rust in the vent caps. And because people would fly those airplanes to the ground, in fact, right over, probably over your house is when I had it happen one time.
Oh, you just
go to the training, you just switch to another tank and you hit fuel boost. But people would fly that thing to the ground, and I'm sitting there thinking, that's pilot error. That's not a manufacturer. Those people were put out of business because of aggressive trial lawyer lawsuits against the companies. And now I'm sitting here, and you're telling me that this is really impacting. I mean, $55,661. I mean, that's a terrible hit on our rural doctors. And I hope each one of you guys watched that OPB piece that was handed out a couple years ago that they did on our rural doctors. That's just a great piece showing the sacrifice that these people make in order to serve a little community. And we've got to figure this thing out, or I don't want to be back on this committee.
Oh, well, that works both ways.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment on that. I'm just going to slide out of here. Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing us today. I appreciate the attention the committee has given to this, and I'm hoping we can bring back those amendments very quickly to you for your consideration.
Okay. And we are going to take comments. And there's one more person to testify. Corey, I would like to take a minute, maybe before we leave, to talk about the confusing issue of where exactly the money is coming from. I think there's some misunderstanding about that, whether or not it is actually in the reserve fund of SAFE or it's a slightly different fund, and why that funding may not be available in the future. So,
Mr. Chair, would you like me to address that very briefly right now? I'm certainly happy to do that.
Well, okay. Dr. Owens? Hello?
Oh, this is Dr. Leslie Stone.
Okay.
Dr. Owens, will you be on after me?
Okay.
And would you like me to go ahead and begin?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak with you all. In brief, I just wanted to give myself as an example of how accessibility to health care is partly geographic, but it's also largely, as you well know, a malpractice and health care insurance crisis. And using my practice as an example, my malpractice premium increased 300% since 2000. And in the last year, last June, for example, my half-year premium jumped $20,000 for a half year. Now, to a family practitioner who doesn't have alternative procedural means for obtaining reimbursement, it's a practice killer, is what it is. And as another example, this health insurance premiums for our employees also escalated in that same time period 300%. without realizing that we are fairly geographically, limited, especially compared to, say, Portland or Eugene. It is true that we would be unable to continue our obstetric practice, which threatens our ability to keep the birthing center open here in Ashland, which really does provide for underserved and otherwise unserved population. I'd like to stop here and then hand the phone over to Dr. Rollins.
Dr. Stone?
Hold on just a minute, Dr. Stone.
All right.
Yes, what's, are you an obstetrician?
I am a family practice physician.
Okay.
Who actually started in obstetrics and GYN with my first year training up at OHSU in Portland, and then decided to go back into family practice, decided that that was not quite enough obstetrics training, completed a high-risk obstetrics and GYN fellowship down through UCLA in Ventura, California, and have subsequently practiced in only underserved rural areas, particularly in North Idaho, until moving to Ashland to be closer to family in 2000.
Well, we're so glad you're here, and we want you to stay here.
Thank you very much. We want to stay here, too, and we also want to be able to continue to provide healthcare for all of these people here who really have no other place to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so now I hand off to Dr. Rollins.
Dr. Rollins.
Hi. This is Jannie Rollins. I'm another family practice doctor here in Ashland, and currently I'm the chair of OB at our hospital. I can kind of echo some of what Leslie said, but throw a little bit two other aspects into it. It's a little bit unusual down here in Ashland. We have a pretty alternative community and a lot of patients who come to see us who want to have natural birth options. We have 14 midwives that are, most of them are lay midwives without a lot of training or education or certification. And we are actually responsible for receiving transport to those patients at this point in time because our two OBGYN specialists that we used to have quit because of the malpractice, leaving us in family practice with the bag of all the high-risk deliveries. And there's quite a few patients that do choose to have a home birth, but we've been here, those of us that are working have been here long enough to establish, a community presence, and we're drawing a lot of patients in that would otherwise choose home birth because of what we do in Ashland, which is focused on, well, not only natural birth, but a lot of patients want natural birth, and those patients, if they didn't have us, would not choose to go somewhere else in this valley. I've been told by many patients, I'm only coming here because it's you, and, if this is somewhere else, we wouldn't go to a hospital, we'd have home birth. And there are a lot of high-risk things happening at home right now. There's twins being born at home, there's moms with diabetes, with high blood pressure. What did you say? Oh, yeah, and the other subject is the whole, it's called VBAC, vaginal birth after C-section, which in the OB field is a really hot topic right now. That it's pretty much impossible to do in most towns, and at this point, no one in Oregon except for us, and I believe OHSU with their residency program are the only two places where women can do a vaginal birth after a C-section. And we feel that that's a pretty amazing service that we offer. We have to be there for the patient's entire labor, have anesthesia and OR personnel, and we're fairly committed to that. And those people are high risk and should not be delivering at home. There are some people who've chosen to do that at home, which we think is ridiculous and dangerous, but there will be more of those if we aren't available. So that's another small aspect. And, it's really unfortunate that that article was written about doctors in Ashland because we're just, primary care people, and I don't think it's fair to lump us with all the other specialists. I drive a 1994 Toyota Previa. I don't, we're normal people. I have two little kids, and I have a small solo practice with one nurse, one receptionist, and me. And I do a lot of Oregon Health Plan. I see patients that are cash pay. We try not to discriminate based on insurance, but we get paid so little from Oregon Health Plan. If we don't have help, we're not even going to pay our premium, let alone break even and be able to pay our staff. And I'm sure you are aware that there's this crisis in primary care, not just family practice, but for pediatricians and internal medicine people, just to even run a practice is getting harder and harder. Everything, the overhead is just pinching right and left. And this is a huge pinch. That what would happen is we would have to quit OB, and we'd close our birth center, which I think is really, really sad if that happened. And that would also affect, you know, other underserved population. We also, Dr. Delgado might want to talk about that with the La Clinica Del Valle program that delivers at our hospital, too. So I guess I should stop talking. I could talk forever. Does anybody have any questions?
Well, the birthing center, which you mentioned earlier, that's where the natural childbirth...
Yeah, it's the hospital, our hospital OB birth center at Ashland Community Hospital.
Okay,
I see. Freestanding unit. The regular hospital, we call it our birthing center.
Okay, good, thank you.
And just clarification with the amendments, is it Ashland physicians are taken out? Or the family physicians and OBs are left in? I forgot. I should wait till the amendments come.
Well, we're afraid that we will be taken out.
Okay, hold on.
I'm not sure if she's asking me that.
No, we're asking Dr. Bates that.
Dr. Rollins, this is Alan Bates.
Hi.
I've offered an amendment that takes the family practitioners who are doing obstetrics in Ashland and puts them on what we call a glide path, where you will not be dropped off the cliff suddenly, but there will be a reduction on an annual basis against your premium over the next 4 years. And we can go over that when we have more time. Right now, that is being considered by the committee and is in the amendments coming out next week. We hope they've had that in place. We just felt we were dropping off a cliff and it wasn't appropriate to do that. I'll give you that amendment as soon as we get it and see what we can do to help you out. I have a lot of sympathy for what you're going through, and you weren't able to attend the meeting where I was there last week and came down and talked to everybody.
I didn't know about it, or I would have been there.
I'm sorry. Some of your partners were there, or some of the people you share coverage with were there. I'm sorry you missed that meeting. I assumed you were probably tied up working. And I'll be glad to have further conversation with you when I'm back in district, which will be this weekend, if you want to contact me again.
Okay. What you're proposing will after over a period of 4 years, will then eliminate us from the program?
It would still eliminate you from the program in 4 years. However, part of the conversation earlier today was that we're looking in the next session at a subsidy that would be probably not just for people in rural Oregon, but for across the state. It's a bigger program. We have to talk about that at a later time.
Okay.
There is a glimmer of hope on the horizon, but I don't want to tell you it's an absolute.
All right. Well, I'm going to hand the phone over to Dr. John Delgado, okay?
Thank you.
Hi, John Delgado here. Dr. Delgado,
this is Senator Bill Morissette. I'm the chair of the committee. You are speaking to a panel, and we do have an audience.
Great.
Dr. Bates is standing by to answer any tough questions that you have.
Okay, very, very good. So, at the initial, I just present my component of the story here. Again, I've been practicing here for 16 years in Ashland. Came up from a rural training center.
Did you say 6 or 16?
16.
Thank you.
And took over the practice of Dr. William Sammons, who was one of the founding community members of the city, and primary physicians here that established initially the La Clinica Del Valle, and that's been a thriving service to the community in the region for the underserved, principally. About a third of the deliveries at Ashland Hospital were from La Clinica Del Valle. Two-thirds of the babies delivered at Ashland Hospital are in the Medicaid population, underserved primarily. Certainly the impact of restricting our reimbursement for malpractice insurance will make it impossible for most, if not all of us, to practice in that setting, and that would significantly negatively impact access for those people. So the vast majority of the deliveries at Ashland Hospital are for the underserved and rural setting appropriately then designated. we and all of us that are doing primary care physician practice with obstetrics all take organ transplantations, and the babies are delivered in that setting as well. So none of us have restricted our practices to private pay only. So we're all continuing that service that was initiated here in Ashland, but there is no other community health service for obstetrics in Ashland. So the group from La Clinica de Valle serves physicians for the patients in the Phoenix, Talent, Medford area, and they are delivering all at Ashland Hospital as well. So we have a primary care base here, and our privileges are right now limited to Ashland Hospital based on our region and the busyness that we do. We have about 350 births a year that we do that keeps us quite busy. So that shifting of population over to Medford would be a big, difficult impact, and also one that would not likely be handled sufficiently by the physician group in Medford. That's the primary issue, is again addressing all the needy that are served here primarily. Again, the big bulk of the population being a Medicaid population. I'm not sure if you have any questions along that line.
Okay. Questions from the committee. Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Dr. Colo is the last person to...
Oh, okay. Good.
Okay,
good.
Very good.
Yes, thank you.
How many doctors do you have in
Ashland?
62. Hi, this is Lucinda Colo.
Welcome, Doctor. Thank you. Go ahead and give your testimony.
Oh, okay. I've been in practice for 5 years now, 3.5 of which was in a community health center in Cave Junction, Oregon. And I'm going to speak from a very personal level because I think the other guys touched the main topics. But I started a new practice here March 6th, and currently I have about 20 people who will deliver between now and September. 17 of those are Oregon Health Plan, 2 are self-pay, and 1 of them has private insurance. As my malpractice premium matures, I will pay $53,000 a year to be able to do obstetrics. Without OB, I would pay $12,000. The average reimbursement for an Oregon Health Plan patient for a delivery is $1,700. That means I would deliver 32 babies a year just to make my malpractice. And I just can't see, you know, wanting to have a life outside of work. And I have an 18-month-old, you may have heard in the background. I drive a 97 Ford Escort, and, you know, I'm not doing this to get rich. And I never want to turn people away because their insurance is Medicaid, and I don't see that I could continue to do this if I'm expected to pay $53,000 a year. So that's about all I have.
Is there a shortage of practitioners who deliver babies in Ashland?
There are only, 4 or 5 of us now? There are 5 of us, and one of them will be retiring, and I guess she also stopped due to her malpractice costs. The OB-GYNs in town stopped delivering, and some of the people I knew in the neighboring towns also stopped delivering due to the cost of malpractice. So our draw is really all, you know, the rural areas surrounding Ashland as well. So I would say, yes, there is a shortage.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Dr.
Chair Morissette.
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't know if they can hear me in Ashland, but can I make a comment?
Yes. Go ahead and give us your name again. So that
this is Alan Bates. I'm state senator and physician in Medford area. I appreciate your testimony today, and you're taking the time from your practice. I know how busy you are to speak to the committee. I appreciate that you've done that for us. Also want to let you know that as a result of the trip we took down there last week and the conversation we had, that some of you may not have heard, but we have offered an amendment to try to make this less onerous. And Corey Sinziger, who's sitting next to me, has pointed out to me that the subsidy does not drop to zero. It is maintained for the next 4 years. And during that time, we hope we have a much bigger solution to this problem, not just for obstetrics, which is not only a rural problem, but an urban problem as far as medical malpractice is concerned, and the loss of obstetrics across the state, but for other physicians and other nurse practitioners in other areas, as both from point of view of specialty and urban and rural also. It's a growing problem. One has not gone away, and we're going to have to deal with this, or we're going to end up with a shortage of physicians across the entire state that we really can't deal with. But thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate my local physician stepping up.
Down. I was there at the meeting, but never got to introduce myself to you. So.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You sound like you have a healthy baby.
I do.
Baby.
He's very healthy.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Is talent in our talent in Phoenix rural?
If you were to drive from Central Point to Medford to Talent to Phoenix to Ashland, you, for the most part, would not know when you cross from one to the other. They're up and down the I-5 corridor there, all abutting the corridor. The two hospitals in Medford both offer obstetrics, Providence and Rogue Valley. Rogue Valley is as close to Talent in Phoenix as Ashland is. Ashland is offering, as they pointed out, a different kind of service to a certain degree, and a lot of people choose to go to Ashland because of that. The service offered at Rogue Valley is fairly similar, but probably a little more clinical. And people have a feeling that the ambience at Ashland Community Hospital is more in tune at times with a certain lifestyle that Ashland has. The amount of Medicaid babies being born in this state is huge. I think it's 40% or 50%. Give me help back here. I'm always amazed the number of the deliveries in the state are by most points Medicaid, not private insurance. I think it's about a 50-50 or 60-40 ratio. So the ratio in Ashland sounds a little higher, but probably not much higher.
Tell us about the birthing center.
Birthing center at Ashland?
Yeah.
I've only been there once.
Okay.
It appears to be about the same type of facility as we have in the birthing center at Rogue Valley Hospital and at Providence. These are all private rooms offering a home-like setting for patients that are very similar to the settings they have at their own homes.
Okay. I guess I was referring to the type of deliveries that are made at the birthing center and the physicians, the four people that we heard who claim they are the only four or five people who deliver babies in Ashland.
That would be correct. High risk, the difference I would say between them and Medford is that a high-risk delivery, if it can be identified in advance, it would be going to Rogue Valley Hospital because they have an NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit there, so there would be immediate transfer to the intensive care unit if there's a problem with obstetrics. Sometimes you can't predict those situations, and those children have to be transferred by ambulance the 10 miles to Rogue Valley up the freeway.
So are you concerned about losing some of these doctors in Ashland that are working at the birthing center doing that kind of work?
I'm concerned about losing obstetrics in this state as we know it.
Yeah.
We could lose it across the board. This isn't just an Ashland problem. This is sort of Ashland's the tip of the spear here. First place you're going to see it. You're going to see it in rural Oregon where people are going to be traveling hundreds of miles or leaving in their fourth or fifth month of pregnancy and living in a big city trying to get care. You're going to see it, the last place you'll see it will be, I expect, be in Portland where you have a high commercial number of carriers so they can offload the cost of the malpractice onto their commercial insurance. And that subsidizes their Medicaid payments.
Now, how many physicians in Ashland altogether?
62.
I think there's 52. 62
or 63.
62. That number, how many deliver babies?
I believe there's four left.
Then why are you even considering putting them on a glide path? I don't understand that.
The reason is because we believe that the shift of those 350 deliveries to Medford is not something that's unsustainable, something that can be done. If it was up to me and we had the money, I would not put them on a glide path. I just continue the present subsidy. It's not up to me. We haven't got that money right now.
Well, it's a matter of priorities. You're the one who's determining the priorities.
Me personally?
Well, your committee.
It was me personally. I was chief of the lobby.
Maybe it's up to our committee to determine the priorities. Senator Bonestan.
Thank you. I'm going to get back to that statement you said. There's what, around 4,000 births in the state of Oregon? Or is it 3,500? I forget. Anyway, and half of those are Medicaid?
I believe about half. I have
half
to go back and check.
Half of the babies are Medicaid.
I believe that's the case. If I'm wrong, I could be corrected.
My numbers are correct.
I can't believe that we have so many low-income. Wow.
Well, there's another figure that's even more striking. That's the number of unplanned pregnancies. What percentage of pregnancies are unplanned?
Well, more than 50%. Probably 75%.
Yeah. So that's a bit of a shock too sometimes.
Well, I was wondering if this actually compares with other states, like the state of Washington. So is it nationwide where half of the births are Medicaid? I mean, that tells us something about our nation, if that's truly...
I frankly don't know.
Yeah. Here comes Dr. Smith.
But let me pursue another point, line of questioning.
I just wanted to add for Senator Mona Sanderson, if you think of Medicaid, it was designed for... children and pregnant women. I'm sorry, Janine Smith, Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research.
Sorry.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Let me... But how many... Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
Can she finish up my...
There's categories of who is covered in Medicaid, and one of the key categories was pregnant women and children. And so the TANF population is predominantly pregnant women and children, so that is why there's a large number of children being covered or born under Medicaid, and it is as high as they're saying. I don't have the exact number, but it's been a known trend for a long time, and it's true in most all states.
Thank you.
Sorry that I didn't.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Chair Morissette.
Yeah. How many doctors in Ashland are receiving a subsidy?
At
the present moment, 64, say 60 doctors.
I would say every doctor in Ashland at the present moment is receiving a subsidy until this program is ended and the new program is brought in. Is that
now
correct, Tori?
That's correct.
If
yes.
You prioritize the doctors who should continue, now, how many doctors are going to be on the glide path of those 60?
Just the obstetricians, just the family practitioners who are doing obstetrics.
How many does that...
I think there's five now, soon to be four.
And these are the people on the glide path.
That is correct.
They
Mr.
are the
Chair.
People who will fall off the cliff at the end of 4 years.
Mr. Chair, I'm getting a sensation or a sense that maybe we should ask for a slight change in the amendment if it would satisfy and please you, sir.
He's going to bug you until you do.
And since I like to be able to sleep at night and sit down during the day, I will have a discussion with a good doctor to my left and to Corey Sajinger, and we will look at that from a financial point of view and report back to you as we have been apparently ordered to do so.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Well, I haven't been drafted yet, right?
I was drafted once in my life. I don't plan to be.
No, no, the amendment.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could just venture in, again, for the record, Corey Streisinger, in addition to the finances, there is also simply a question of prioritization and of equity. And this program does not serve all physicians in Oregon. It's designed to serve rural Oregon specifically. That doesn't mean that there aren't Medicare babies being delivered throughout Oregon. There are. It's simply a limited program. It serves actually a very, modest percentage of Oregon doctors for a number of reasons. So the discussion about the urbanized areas was really to say, is this group of physicians more like physicians in Burns or more like physicians in Salem. And, you know, this is a gradation. But the conclusion of the work group was that, in fact, Ashland is an urbanized area that is more akin to the areas not covered by this program than the areas that are covered by the program. So just a slightly expanded explanation of why the work group tended to be where it
was. I've heard that rationale. I mean, I've heard that rationale. And I, in listening to the testimony from the four practicing physicians, all of whom feel that they're at risk in terms of continuing their practice and in the style that they've been doing it, it just, you know. And besides, it is officially designated rural, isn't it?
Depending on what criteria that the federal government is using for what particular program.
Definitions.
We had 20 different overlays of what was rural, not rural, was urbanized, not urbanized.
But the interesting thing is you're taking an officially designated non-rural and making it, keeping it rural, and an officially designated rural and making it non-rural, it seems to me. Well, Ashland, Grants Pass.
I must be getting a low blood sugar here, but you're right. Well, the difference, here's the criteria I kept going back to over and over again in my mind. That was retention and recruitment. Does Ashland have a problem retaining and recruiting physicians? Actually, it doesn't. We have the highest population of physicians, practicing physicians, to population in the state, I believe. I'll have to go back and check those figures. If it's not the highest, it's close to it. We have a very dense population of physicians as far as being available to the group of people being served. On the other hand, OB in Ashland stands out as the real difference as far as whether people stay or don't stay as far as the subsidy is concerned. I do believe if they lose the subsidy entirely, they will not have obstetrics in Ashland. The question then arises, is that appropriate or not appropriate? It's 10.2 miles to the next hospital on I-5, and it's never closed. It's not bad weather. There's not a mountain to go over. It's dead flat. And, you know, the question is, are they offering a service in Ashland that we want to retain as a state, or is it something we want to transfer to Rogue Valley Hospital and Providence Hospital? That's a tough question, not an easy one to answer. And I'm, as a physician living in that area and working in that area and knowing the population, it's one that I have a very difficult time answering myself. If the chair would like to see an amendment stating, in effect, that we try to maintain that program in Ashland just for obstetrics, I'd be glad to look at that further and bring it back to you for your consideration.
Now, I did visit Meg's clinic. Meg. She runs three clinics in Ashland. Meg?
Peg Crowley.
Oh, okay. Yes, okay. I did.
Okay.
We did visit Peg Crowley's clinic. And we spent a little bit of time there. We didn't finish visit the other two. There's one in White City and another. And so these are the... Now, I don't know that they do... They don't deliver babies at that clinic.
They do prenatal work there, and most of the deliveries occur at Rogue Valley. That's three of our safety net clinics.
Okay, a safety net clinic... Now, it seems to me that the birthing center, now I haven't visited the physical facility, but it sounds like the population of Ashland kind of likes natural birth, right? Some of the population. And those are the people who go to that natural birthing center, I would assume.
I believe that's correct.
And so it just seems to me that the four people who are able to deliver babies there at a birthing center, for people who are Medicaid, I mean, they work with the Medicaid people, that would be a very valuable service to have.
Ms. Chair, I'd also point out, I mean, Dr. Bates does have a good point to a degree, about the 10 miles, because in rural Oregon, 10 miles is nothing.
That's nothing.
It makes a difficult decision. And I am not entirely without prejudice living where I do, so you're probably asking the wrong person for an answer on this.
Well, it just seems to me that of the 60-some doctors, all, let's say if you did keep them in, all but four would be discontinued from the program, and that's a huge shift, you know, from a man that lives on a hill to you know, people who work in the trenches.
The disparity and reimbursement for physicians in this country has grown to be something that is a major disruptor of the system. It does not exist in other countries. Mm-hmm. We expect that our subspecialists and our specialists, because of extra training and what they do, should be paid more.
Yeah.
But the gulf between them and primary care has become the Grand Canyon. It is part of what is driving us towards health care reform, because we cannot afford to continue to have the high-tech care we have and no primary preventative care. And this is a very good example of that.
And the adverse publicity that happened as a result of someone not returning a phone call to the press. And if you don't return a phone call, then who knows where you're going to end up, on which front page you're going to end up on, which...
And just so people make very aware here, Mr. Chair, it was not me that did not return the phone call.
No, I know that.
I returned the phone call.
No. What I'm saying is that that really put, you know, the focus on that community and the, you know, the person who received that subsidy, you know, was not one that was providing the essential services necessarily, unless there was reconstructive surgery that was performed and so on. But it was interesting to hear the testimony, and I didn't realize it was down to that number of four or five with one person leaving. Now, an anecdotal comment that I heard that I thought was very telling was the physician's spouse who ended up in Pendleton, Oregon. That was at a rural health conference, and the gentleman came up and said, you know, my wife is a physician, and we moved here, I believe, from Arkansas or Tennessee. Because of this program, we went to Portland first and realized that that was not the place to go, and so they now live in Pendleton, and there is, you know... So that's an interesting point, and so the program has huge value to physicians, to practicing physicians. One willing to move to Oregon, one willing to go to a rural community. Pendleton, a rural community? Is that a rural community?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Even when you're downtown Pendleton, it's still a rural community.
But, I mean, that shows how important the program is, and I just would hate to see, you know, people leave it. Okay, thank you very much. We do have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, committee. Thank you. Dr. Elizabeth Steiner, are you?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Rural is defined by most of us as a place in which at least twice a year cows are found on Main Street.
Is that true in your city?
Sure. Oh. Yeah, we're not a one-horse town.
Oh, you're a two-horse.
No, they're a two-cow town, obviously, so...
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Steiner. I'm a family physician, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. And I also have the privilege of serving on the work group that was thinking about amendments for Senate Bill 183. One of the things that we all know is that provision of high-quality health care is critical to the survival of rural communities. And family physicians provide a significant percentage of that health care. So obviously this is an issue that is near and dear to our hearts. Many family physicians and other physicians and healthcare providers in those communities have had real difficulty, as some of the previous witnesses have pointed out, staying in practice because of the very high cost of malpractice premiums, and it really makes it non-viable economically to stay in practice in these communities. As Dr. Smith pointed out with her study and with the data that she presented, the subsidy over the past several years has made an enormous difference in the ability of family physicians, obstetrician gynecologists, and other physicians to stay in practice in our rural communities and to assure that Oregonians living in these rural communities have access to high-quality medical care. One of the things that those of us on the work group focus on, and I think the previous witnesses have attested to, is that we want this subsidy to support what we define as critical access services. In other words, care that cannot be safely provided by flying a patient somewhere else. For example, it's really not safe to put a woman in a helicopter if she's having distress in labor to send her to another hospital to deliver her baby. That's not a good plan. On the other hand, even if somebody has a fairly significant leg fracture, it's not pleasant for them to fly somewhere else, but it's safe. And that's the distinction that the work group tried to make in terms of thinking about what group would be, how physicians would be divided into the various categories. And as was pointed out, the ones that are most important are those providing obstetrical services, and then physicians who provide primary care, such as family medicine, general internal medicine, pediatrics, and some other core services like general surgery and anesthesiology that we really need to maintain in our rural communities to make sure patients get timely, effective, safe medical care are that category that would stay on the 40% and not go on the glide path. And that's something that we fully support, because those are the services that allow family physicians to provide full scope care in our rural communities. The new bill, as I said, focuses on subsidizing these critical access services, and that's really where this money should be spent. The family physicians believe that the requirement that Corey Streisinger mentioned of serving Medicare and Medicaid patients is an appropriate requirement, and we fully support that amendment. This is state money and business money subsidizing physicians across the state, and we ought to be providing service for the neediest Oregonians in response. So we do support that amendment. In general, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians fully supports all the proposed amendments, and we were honored to have the opportunity to serve on the work group to help make this bill into something that will help all Oregonians in our rural areas have access to high-quality health care. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Corey, could you tell us a little bit about the funding mechanism and exactly... we talked about this morning, and I wasn't aware of what you told me beforehand, just for the record, so to speak.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and again, for the record, Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The funding, the program as it was initially put together in 2003, the funding source identified was through SAFE, the State Accident Insurance Fund, but it is not actually SAFE funds. The programs administered by SAFE, reimburses for the premiums that the participating physicians would otherwise pay, but SAFE then receives a credit against the premium assessments which it collects from its employers who purchase workers' compensation insurance from SAFE, and which it then transfers to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This premium assessment is added to all workers' compensation across the state, and the funds then are used as the source for the administrative expenses of the work administering the workers' compensation programs in my department. In 2003, that fund had built up some excess for a number of reasons, and funds were extremely tight in 2003, and for a number of reasons the legislature decided, and we proposed and the legislature agreed, that that was on a one-time basis a source of funds that that should appropriately be used for this program. And the dollar figure was capped at $40 million, and it was anticipated that that $40 million would be spent during the four-year time frame of the initial program. That is, that it would cost an average of $10 million a year. In fact, the costs have been quite a bit less than that, and in the initial 4 years, we anticipate that the cost will be, rather than $40 million, will be $21 million. So within that $40 million that was essentially set aside for this purpose, the proposed amendments intend to stretch that for another 4 years, 8 years of funding altogether out of that funding source. But it was never contemplated that those funds that are paid by employers to support the workers' compensation system would be a long-term or permanent source of funding for this program. I think there are many stakeholders involved in workers' compensation, as well as, frankly, our department and the governor, who feel that as a long-term source that really wouldn't be appropriate, but that there's no reason not to make the maximum use of that initial set-aside.
Okay. Now, the put and take, so to speak, you're putting a new classification of people who will be covered, which are nurse practitioners.
Correct.
So, and you're removing another category of physicians in a limited Actually, some would be removed.
And removing a small number from some communities.
Yeah, and then scaling down on others now. But you still think there's going to be a $1 million shortfall, perhaps?
Mr. Chair, the scale down that's proposed in the bill, we did a lot of number crunching. I think Senator Bates mentioned many different glide paths. And we can provide you with a glide path, if you will, that will come basically to $0 at the end of the four-year program. The feeling of the group was that the bill should set ceilings but not floors. Because if, in fact, there are fewer physicians participating or insurance rates drop or for some other reason the funds stretch further than we anticipate, we want room to be able to provide the reimbursement. But unless there are changes or additional funding is found, the glide path will actually need to be somewhat steeper than the ceilings specified in the bill. The feeling of the work group was leave room, don't squeeze it down as tight as you possibly can. But we do anticipate that there will be funding for the program for the entire 4 years. It's just a question of the steepness of the glide path, if you will.
And that will depend somewhat on how many exactly people are added to it. Now, do you have a
Correct.
Firm number on the nurse practitioners? And
Mr. Chair, we have an estimate. The estimate is slightly over 300 nurse practitioners at roughly $1,500 per nurse practitioner, a much a smaller number of certified nurse midwives, but also a proportionately higher premium.
Yes, yeah. Senator Cruz.
In 2003, it was determined that there was in the fund that created the fund, an excess of $40 million, and so that was pulled out and set aside, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, it wasn't precisely pulled out, but from a sort of projection standpoint,
right,
yes.
Right. How is that fund doing currently, yours?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we actually try to manage that fund so as not to build up an excess beyond a prudent fund balance. So we reduce the assessment, and we have reduced it.
Okay.
Employers are paying less as a result, and the numbers are about where they should be.
Okay. I was just thinking, Mr. Chair, Bates is going to go try to beg some from the co-chairs. We ought to just steal it from Corey, but, you know, that's my thought.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, thank you so much for that invitation.
Well, we could always take it just from Chris, just the reserve.
He was planning not to be noticed.
Chris Davies, well, how can he sit there with a big smile on his face and not be noticed?
Mr. German, I suggest we take it from the capital remodel.
What remodel?
Very good question. That thing that may not happen, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 183, and we will open a public hearing and hopefully we'll meet this and possible work session, on House Bill 2242, and Mr. Dave McKee is here to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave McTeague, Board of Chiropractic Examiners, office here in South Salem. House Bill 2242 is a minor tune-up bill, really. Does several minor adjustments to the...
Excuse me. When you told me it was minor, I thought I would wait to see how many people were going to show up before I agreed. And there's... I think they're all leaving.
That means minor.
So it is minor.
So I don't need a rearview mirror.
No, you don't.
the first thing this bill does is try to address a little hole that we think we've encountered in our statutory framework. If we were to be looking at a case involving a finding that a applicant or a licensee had some serious issues that weren't necessarily covered by a felony conviction or a misdemeanor conviction involving moral turpitude. And the definition of what is moral turpitude is kind of not really codified anywhere, and sometimes lawyers will argue, well, that conviction isn't a moral turpitude conviction, and we'll go, well, we think it is, but they think it's not. And there was a case in front of another licensing board that really kind of focused our thoughts on this, where an applicant was determined by circuit court civil ruling to have sexually abused his stepdaughter, and that wasn't did not result in a, or was not the subject of a misdemeanor or felony conviction. So working with our legal counsel, we came up with some draft language.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
That was not a chiropractor, though, right?
No, it wasn't a chiropractor. No, it was another. Okay. It was another licensee. Mm-hmm. You know, these situations are rare, but they could occur, and we just see this as a potential area where we might have a problem if we have a serious situation that needs to be addressed in a mostly probably an applicant. Situation. So we propose some language that says an act or conduct derogatory to the practice of chiropractic or that chiropractic assisting would cause a reasonable person to have substantial doubt about the individual's ability to safely practice chiropractic. And so that example is the kind of thing that we want to make sure that we have the ability to address as a public safety issue if it were to come in front of the board.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
That is the section that I have questioned on. And that define for me an act or conduct derogatory to the practice of chiropractic.
You know, I've just given you that example. That's the kind of thing that we're thinking about. You know, if there's a civil court judgment that says here's a serious, serious issue, and we think we might want to deny that license, for example, that we would have a provision in law that would clearly speak to that situation, and we don't think we have that right now. We could fall back on a more generic, you know, unprofessional conduct, but the person, if he's not a licensee, that might not apply to them either, and this would more clearly do so.
If I could follow up.
Yes.
In that sentence it says, would have substantial doubt, this is line 23, about the individual's ability to safely practice chiropractic care. What would abuse of one's daughter, if in fact it was rendered that, I mean, that's going to be handled by someone else, and this person's probably going to be in a state prison. How would that relate to that definition and affect their ability to practice?
Well, it relates back to the doctor-patient relationship and the power differentials that are inherent in that relationship, and the fact that the doctor is in a fiduciary position relative to patients. So if you were to abuse your power position in a parent-child relationship, that there's a fairly close parallel to the doctor-patient relationship in terms of the patient-doctor power differential, and that's where we're very aware of that issue. I think that's how that would relate.
You know my fear of what I think you and your board do. I think you go back and you rewrite this to specify what you just said. I think this is too broad a language, and it worries me very much based upon my experience with the board.
All right, duly noted.
Well, okay. Any other comments, questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was kind of wondering about that language too, but so if I could. So basically, I mean this would kind of open it up. So you're looking for the ability to act. I mean, you mentioned something about a civil suit or something like that,
right,
or criminal suits. So it's based on something actionable,
or something that's clearly has been documented as a very serious issue, very serious concern.
For example, if he had gotten two DUIs or something like that, but how does that necessarily
No, the DUI, that wouldn't by itself result in a license denial. That mean the board might have some concerns with somebody who's exhibited a chronic alcohol problem and may raise, address those issues in other ways with an applicant and has. But we're thinking about some really serious stuff here.
But basically, Ms. Chair, basically things that have gone to litigation would need to be something that serious.
Yes, I would. Yeah, that's what I would. Something that's where there's a document like a circuit court judgment or ruling that where this is clearly delineated.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Jones.
Section 6 says that the Board of Chiropractic Examiners may refuse to grant license to any applicant. And number D there, letter D, which is on line 21 on page 4, says a conviction for felony misdemeanor involving moral
correct.
Conduct.
Right.
So this, why would this not be covered by that?
Because not everything results in a conviction.
So an accusation of moral turpitude?
No. No, we're saying it's like a circuit court judgment or finding or ruling that it may not have been prosecuted for whatever reason, but it was litigated, and the court rendered a ruling that said, here's the serious concerns, and the board wants the ability to look at that issue and deliberate on it without it being excluded from the consideration process and whether somebody should be licensed to practice chiropractic or not.
Additional questions?
Yes.
Okay. Now I'm at the bottom of page 3. Requirement, new language in there, a pain management education program approved by the Board of Chiropractic Care, developed in conjunction with the Pain Management Commission. There's concern in my mind from the standpoint of the division that occurs within the chiropractic community relative to the use of drugs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And my question is this going to be used to force those who do not believe in utilizing drugs as a chiropractor to get them to buy into this majority group's view that we use drugs?
No, and really, I don't think there is a majority chiropractic point of view about promoting prescription drug use by chiropractors. That issue was brought up the other day, and a former college president wanted to create this program, and it was very controversial within the profession. And ultimately, they kind of said, "Okay, we get the message. We're not going there." And really the profession isn't pushing for that in any way. The Pain Management Commission and effort was set up by Senator Joan Duke's legislation about three sessions ago, if I remember correctly, and we're still implementing that. And I think the bolded language here, I believe, is just a legislative council rewrite of this language. I don't think this isn't any change that we're proposing.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the current language says board, and this makes State Board of Chiropractic Examiners, so I think that's just defining board.
Legislative Council is having a lot of fun with cleaning up our laws these days, I guess. So,
Mr. Chairman, I spotted that. I just wanted to get that question on the air.
Sure.
I'm not part of the Pain Management Commission. I've been to a number of their meetings, and they did an interesting flip-flop on the Senate Bill 34, which we passed, because originally they were opposed to that because some of their members felt it was...
They were uninformed,
right.
We've been telling our docs about this continuing education
but
requirement for about 3 years.
On the other hand, and Senator Mona Sanderson is a member of the Pain Commission, and she attends our meetings, and I'm sure that she would support this because the Pain Commission has been trying to get all of the disciplines to understand the importance of pain, mitigation, and not necessarily by drugs, but other means. And so acupuncturists, chiropractors, everybody is encouraged to, get involved in that. So,
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
You're going to need to look at this again because I think we just passed legislation. Basically, the Pain Commission is getting out of the development of education.
Oh, okay.
And, remember, because they're going to become more advisory at this point, because most disciplines, they just want to advise the disciplines in the development of curriculum. They just thought it was a better nexus for them rather than being actually involved in the curriculum development. So
we'll take a look at that.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the case, back to the line 45 again.
Okay. Yes.
Then
now, where are you on?
Okay, I'm back at the pain management idea again. Okay. Because then, what would be the view of the board relative to pain management education if, in fact, they're just advising you might want to think about it rather than a requirement in developing a program?
Well, I am not aware of them getting out of the advisory. Well, I don't know.
Well, they're still advisory.
Advisory.
Bill.
Pardon me?
We passed the bill out of here.
Okay.
I believe, didn't we?
We'll check it out.
Yeah. We'll take a look and see how that legislation affects it. This language was there right into our bill three sessions ago.
Could you provide me with what you consider to be training in this area of pain management?
We have a list on our webpage of the available continuing education courses.
I need details on
okay.
it. Okay.
Sure, we can show you. We'll show you what we're showing the docs, and we say this is what you can take in this area. It's fairly wide open for them.
A bit of information that Senator Cruz found that he will.
Yeah, the statute for the commission needs to talk about. They develop a pain management practice program for providers. That was what was deleted. But they're still in the business of making recommendations. So, I mean, they're mm-hmm. tweaking and you're tweaking. Everybody tweaks in different cycles, I guess. So we're always playing catch-up with each other in this process. Okay. So
that will save you one step. And so you will go, you'll come back with a different, a tighter version of the issue that we...
On the CE issue, pain management. I'll take a look at that, right.
Well, on Senator George's first issue.
Yeah.
The language. Yeah, we have to. I mean, we have a big thing of legal advice on this, and that was the version that she recommended. I think there was another version. I'd be happy to go over with her and see if we can tighten up on that and make that more specific to perhaps a court ruling or something like that, where there's been a finding that's been adjudicated somehow.
Dave, so. I would love to see that because I'd like to see what that really means. When I saw it, I went, whoops, antenna went up. What does that mean? What are the definitions? So if we could have that provided by, that would be the AG that works for you guys?
I would go back to the attorney, okay. The AG and discuss that with her, Ryan.
Okay.
We're changing it. We have this limited active license category, which is chiropractors who've been in practice over 25 years and are over 60. They're called limited active. It's been a real source of confusion, so we want to change the terminology to active senior. That was kind of the consensus choice among folks.
Active
senior. They get a break on their license fee and their continuing ed. They've been in practice over 20 years, so. We're just trying to, that's just been such a headache for us. Another provision is it's kind of a chiropractic Good Samaritan provision, similar to, in some ways, to what the Board of Medical Examiners has that speaks to emergency situations. I just want to make it real clear. We want to make it clear that the chiropractor renders some treatment to somebody in an emergency situation and somehow maybe they did something that's not technically chiropractic. I don't want them to worry about somebody coming back and saying you were outside your scope of practice. So we're just trying to cover that base and also also write in that the administration of emergency oxygen in emergency situations is within the scope of chiropractic. Because there's been questions about that we've recently helped to sort out, but we'd like to have that in the statute as further backup.
I think that's great, Dave. Could you add clarification, if possible, to the idea that a person, like, for example, our senior, 25-year experienced senior chiropractor, who might decide that he want to give away the care, and, you know, the subject is, like, returning veterans and this sort of stuff, and I've been told by more than... probably three or four, that they have had people indicate to them that the board might take action against them for giving care to those that they felt needed the care. And to me, that's just only a credit to the practice of chiropractic medicine.
We have an administrative rule that says chiropractors can give free or reduced cost care to any patient of their choice.
So it's already there.
It is there, and I'm happy to answer practice questions like that and do all the time.
So that was probably a one-on-one, one doctor to another.
I would think we wouldn't want to get in the way of anybody doing gratis care or free care or free clinic care or donated care. That's a good thing. We would encourage that.
Super. Thanks.
Anything else? We have another provision that we have a peer review committee where you have to serve at least five years to be on the peer review committee, but for some reason the statute says you only have to be licensed for 1 year to serve on the board. So we just thought we should make those, sync them up so they're the same. It kind of doesn't make sense to have two different eligibility requirements. So the proposal is to make the minimum requirement for service on the board be 5 years in practice as well. The rest is just basically cleanup, housekeeping language. I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
I think we've nailed you on everything. So.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2242, and we are adjourned.